This is The After Party, live with Kim McAllister. Pick a couch, grab a drink, and settle into the conversation.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The After Party Live. Not very good mixing there with my starting of the music a little bit early, so my apologies on that. Thanks for being here with The After Party Live. Welcome aboard, and I'm glad that you have found us and are ready to party with us this afternoon. It is Trivia Thursday, so super excited about that. Look at you guys in the chat. Thank you for being here. I have put together today a thank you note, for all the people that have contributed to this new portion of the show. We have the ending of the show where there's a thank you notes with your names listed to all the people who have contributed previously. Huge thank you for that. But in the last couple of weeks, as this show transitions to a solo act at this point, a lot of people have switched over to the new PayPal account, and I just want to show my appreciation. So I thought for a minute, if we could, that I could show you what I was working on last night and just take a moment to thank everyone who has done this. So if you don't see your name here, it's because you probably haven't switched over to the account. A lot of people will, if that are contributing to the show, will set up a monthly contribution. And if it's your day for your payment to go through, you may get kicked back and it may say this payment or this account is no longer valid. And that's because one account was closed and a new one was open. So again, these are all the people that have contributed. And I just want to start the show with a humongous thank you to everyone who has participated in helping put this show on the air, on the YouTube air, as it were. One is purple, one row is purple, and one is black, and that's because on my phone I couldn't tell the difference between the colors. There's no indication of anyone being more purple either or black than the other. But thank you to everyone on the screen: Deidre, Susan, Louise, Karen K, Kathy, Deborah, Wes, and Chris, Sheila, Maureen, Paul, Gary, and Sue Ellen. Also, Candida, Carol, Pamela, Joe, Donald, Harold, and Janet, Robin, Kathleen, William, and Ricky for contributing to the show. You guys are amazing. Dillette, Sarah, Julie, Martha, Karen C, Elaine, the Kims, Kim N and Kim H, and the Cynthias, Cynthia J and Cynthia C, Mark H, Gretchen, Shadow Producer Calvin, Heather, Susan D, Lee, Linda G, Sue Ann, Carrie, Nancy, Jim L, Teresa, Laura, James, and Beth. I've got a big old aloha for all of you. Thank you so much for contributing to the show. Find the PayPal information in the show description if you're so inclined. If not, I'm grateful for you hanging out this hour and participating in trivia and all the ways that you're able to do. So let's get the show started, shall we? Let's do it. I also have some new graphics I worked on as well. I'll show you my new Trivia Thursday. I'm pretty excited about this one. What do you think about that? It's hard to see after party style, it says on the bottom. Anyway, we'll do trivia a little bit later. But first, this story comes from Annie. And Annie sent this story in about there finally being a picture of the iceberg that took down the Titanic. Maybe. It's hard to see, but the white on top of the white figure on top of the ocean is that glacier. And it was said at the time that it had an elephant-like shape to it. And you can see here, this one kind of does. This is a 112-year-old photo. And the thinking is that it could hold a fascinating clue to the sinking of the Titanic. 1,522 people died when this ship went down. This image was captured by an undertaker who arrived on a body recovery ship in the aftermath of the sinking of the Titanic. And the image is now for sale at Henry Aldridge & Son Auctioneers for an estimated price of between $5,000 and $8,000. This photo was taken 2 days after the Titanic hit an iceberg on her maiden voyage and sank. The photographer is believed to be funeral director John Snow Jr., who later put this picture on a cardboard mount and named it Titanic. it captures the open water with this very oddly shaped iceberg that, again, resembles an elephant. And when news of the Titanic came in, Snow and his father, who was an undertaker in Nova Scotia, were asked to come to Halifax, Canada, to the area where the Titanic went down. They took a ship, loaded it with 100 coffins and 100 tons of ice to preserve the bodies of victims who they may pull out of the water. It was an 800-mile journey. It took them about 4 hours to reach it by boat. So it arrives again 2 days after the Titanic sinks, and then the body recovery begins, and they start pulling bodies from the ice-cold water. They managed to recover 306 souls of all different classes. The first-class passengers were embalmed on the ship and placed in one of the coffins. The crew did recover the bodies of John Jacob Astor IV, who was the richest man aboard the ship, also Isidore Strauss, the owner of the Macy's department store. Second-class passengers were embalmed and wrapped in canvas. About 116 third-class passengers and crew were buried at sea. So they come to Halifax. They return 7 days later with 190 bodies from the Titanic wreckage. Again, they recovered 306, some buried at sea, and they come home with 190 bodies. And in the meantime, when they're out there doing this, Snow takes this photo of what may well be the iceberg that the ship hit. So it's a 5x3 photo of this iceberg. It had been passed down through the Snow family until it was acquired by a collector of Titanic memorabilia some 30 years ago. Now, the auctioneer is clear on this one. They say no one can say for sure that this is the exact iceberg that sank the Titanic. What they can say is after the rescue ship, the Carpathia, was one of the first ships to after that ship, that was a rescue ship, the undertaker ship, the McKay Bennett, was one of the first ships to reach the wreck site, and that the undertaker on board decided to take a photo of this iceberg. He said he must have had his reasons for taking the picture of this iceberg, that he captioned it Titanic and mounted it for posterity. It was never sold and was acquired directly from the Snow family in the 1990s. And while there's some uncertainty around the image, apparently it's recognized as a rare, fantastic find. And they think it'll attract a lot of interest. So it's going to be auctioned off in England, in Devizes, England, which is a market town about an hour from Bristol. And that's happening April 27th. We'll see what happens. I don't know. Interesting. I bet it goes for a lot of money. They said between $5,000 and $8,000. Maybe more. Who knows? Maybe because of its provenance and they can't prove the fact that it is the exact iceberg, maybe a little bit less. I don't know. Thanks to Annie for sending in that story. I got a couple stories from Lee too. I love when you guys send me the good stuff. Thank you so much. She knows that I love Scrabble. Does this not look like a Scrabble board? No, it doesn't, because it's a new Scrabble board. And for a second, I was kind of excited because I thought, oh, there's a double-sided Scrabble board and it's going to be even harder. No, it's actually supposed to be a little easier for people that are intimidated by word games and kind of want to ease into it, which I think is maybe great for kids especially. But they're getting a new collaborative, accessible version of Scrabble. So that's what you're seeing here. And the original Scrabble has been around for 75 years. And it's, you know, it's not the easiest game to play, right? Especially if you're playing against somebody that is good. My family refuses to play Scrabble with me anymore. But this is what they're doing, is adding a second side to the board that is collaborative and faster paced, so you can work together. And the whole idea is to make it more accessible for people who are intimidated by this type of game. So instead of competing, the players collaborate to complete goal cards. And then there are even helper cards if you need a little assistance, like a little helper card there. So, I mean, maybe it's a good way to ease kids into playing Scrabble, or people that think they don't like word games can do that. The aim of the new game mode is to bring people together. They say Scrabble stood the test of time as one of the most popular board games in history. They say we want to ensure, this is the folks at Mattel, we want to ensure that, Mattel, my bad, I'm sorry, Hasbro. I think it's Hasbro? I thought it was Hasbro. Now I have to double check on that. But they say it's Mattel, my bad, it is Mattel. They say they want to ensure the game continues to be inclusive for all players. So for anyone who's ever thought word games aren't for me, or maybe felt intimidated by the classic game of Scrabble, the Scrabble Together mode is an ideal option. And they kind of came up with this by doing some research among British board gamers that show competitiveness is actually declining in younger generations. See, I think that's the beauty of Scrabble. I mean, you can get cutthroat in Scrabble, right? But they talked to 2,000 people, surveyed them. 35% believe baby boomers are the most competitive, followed by millennials, 31%, and Gen Z, 29%. Where's the Gen Xers? I don't know. Where'd we go? Scrabble Together will be available across Europe. An updated version of this game won't be available in the U.S. because Mattel doesn't hold the license here. So I guess we're going to have to order it from somewhere else. But I thought I'd throw that out there. Being the Scrabble fan that I am, making Scrabble a little less intimidating. I would think that people would be, I don't know, better at Scrabble, more competitive with it because of Words with Friends has been around. So it's easy to play online and maybe you get good at doing that. So then you're better at the actual board game. But hey, maybe it's just not for everyone. Let's get to animals. Look at this guy. He's in Burbank, California. Oops. This bear spotted relaxing in a backyard pool in Burbank. They're coming out of hibernation for the spring. So sightings have increased because they're out there looking for food. And this bear was roaming the front yard of a Burbank home before headed to the backyard for a little dip, a little cool off. The homeowner said, "This is a pretty big bear. He's obviously huge, and it's a scary sight to see." The homeowners lived there for 20 years. They said, "This is the first encounter with a bear on the property. They saw him coming in, strolling in this way. He said he comes by the pool. He takes a little dip. He goes to his back on the scratches back on a nearby palm tree, spends about 5 minutes or so, and then strolls away like nothing happened, you know, as bears do." This bear was first spotted early Sunday morning in the neighborhood in Burbank, at one point going through some garbage cans. There's footage of him kneeling down, going through the garbage. Spent about 15 minutes at this house eating the trash they'd thrown away in the garbage cans. The bear sightings, though, in Burbank and in the foothills of the Verdugo Mountains, just above Burbank, have been increasing. A lot of home surveillance cameras capturing the bears soaking in the hot tubs, swimming in the pools, resting on the patio furniture. The estimation is 40,000 bears are coming out of hibernation in California. So residents who live in bear territory, and I wouldn't have thought that was Burbank, but perhaps, are preparing for the possibility of running into bears now. So the fish and wildlife folks have been notified that the bear's in the neighborhood. So far, he's just hanging out. Or she. Don't know what the gender. Don't want to genderize the bear. No. Next story about birds mimicking sirens. And apparently this can be a little bit confusing for the police when they think they hear the siren and yet it's not the siren. It's birds in the trees mimicking the sirens. So I have a video that I wanted to share with you because I could see how perhaps this could be a little bit confusing. Let's listen. And they even have the the European siren. Yeah. Is that crazy? It happened in Thames Valley. Police said they thought that their vehicles, something was wrong with the sirens. No. Nothing's wrong with the sirens. It's the birds and the trees. Yeah, but they came out, took a look at all that, and they realized that, yeah, it was actually the birds and the trees chirping in the trees, replicating the sound of a two-tone siren. It was a copycat call, they said. It wasn't an April Fool's joke, because they were thinking that as well. But the officers were a little bit confused. They said it was so accurate that they were thought maybe the sirens were broken on the cars or something like that was happening. They said from our workshops that test out the two-tone tune to officers deploying to jobs, this little fella's been patiently observing the noise to try to recreate it. The thought is that maybe it's a starling in the tree, and they're known for their ability to mimic man-made noises. But that's definitely a new one. I don't know if you saw this story about foxes. It turns out that at one time, dogs weren't man's best friend. It appears foxes were humans' best friend. And researchers know this because they found an ancient grave in what is currently northwest Argentina. And a person had been buried with their canine companion, but it wasn't a dog. It was a skeleton of a type of fox. And the relationship between humans and dogs are thousands of years old, but fresh analysis of evidence from a Patagonian burial dating back 1,500 years hints at a very similar connection between humans, a hunter-gatherer in South America, and this large extinct species of fox. Dusicyon avis is the name of the species. So they uncover this nearly complete Dusicyon avis skeleton, large fox skeleton, buried alongside of a human in northern Patagonia in 1991. So there's no cut marks on the bones. The fox had not been eaten. They think that given the fox's species and age, the examination of the collagen and its remains, that it ate the same food that this group of humans did, along with the skeleton's placement in the grave and the animal's diet, it suggested this fox was tame and might have been kept as a pet. This is in a new study published in the journal Royal Society Open Science. And it's more evidence, according to researchers, from burial sites on other continents indicating that individual foxes were tamed by humans and shared the connection based on companionship. So I thought that was interesting because I never realized that we had a connection with foxes. I don't know what, I guess I would think, well, what if it was just this one person that happened to make this connection with a fox? But I guess there's evidence showing that this may have been more widespread. Well, from a serious scientific animal story to now a bit of a wackier story. There's a pet names contest rolling up. This is a pet insurance company who's inviting the public to vote on some of the most unusual pet names for its annual Wacky Pet Name Prize. All right? And some of these names are really funny. So I'm going to read you some of the finalists. There's categories, the dog category, the cat category, and then we have the exotic pet category. So the finalists in the dog category, Boots with the Fur is the name of the animal, Chug Chug Pickles, Little Richard Simmons Sweating to the Oldies, Lord Waddles, Lulu the Conqueror, Molly from Corporate, Mr. Pizza Puff, One Love Tiny Dancer, Princess Margaret Rose Windsor. Team The Bandit Player and the News. So those are dog ones. The cat ones, I think, are great. Balsamic Vin, Car Alarm, Itty Bitty Kitty Committee, Meownaise, Minerva Meowgonigly, Necronomicat, Samsung Family Hub Refrigerator, Skull Crusher, Steph Purry, and Tony Scarface Baloney. To the exotic category now. There's a rabbit named Beezlebun, a ferret named Boo Boo Bean, a snake named Boop Noodle, a guinea pig named Cow Pig, a tegu lizard named Frosted Mini Wheats, a macaw named Magic Nugget, a tortoise named Mid-Sized Sedan, I think that's my favorite of all of them, a ferret named Mumbo Jumbo, a pig named Snoop Hoggy Hog, and a rabbit named Thor Odin Bun, God of Bunder. The voting is open online through tomorrow at petinsurance.com/wackypetnames, and you can check out the finalists and vote for your favorite if you are so inclined there. All right, enough of the goofiness. Let's look at this other story sent in by Lee. This is crazy because you would think that. And here's it. She sends me the clipping. So then I look it up and I find this story out of WOIO 19 News, that this really did happen. This is a story where a man on Easter is at Burger King. He's at the drive-thru. And he rolls through and he's given a better deal than he normally receives for the same items. So usually whatever normal regular order he has costs him $11 and some odd cents. But because it's on special, he only is charged $8 and some odd cents. And for whatever reason, this just rubs him the wrong way. So he's seen in the video getting out of his car, and you can see him there at the drive-thru. He gets angry, he drives away, but he rolls back through the drive-thru around, and he pulls up alongside the car that is dealing with the person in the drive-thru. And he gets out and he points the gun at the drive-thru clerk. And he's angry. And then finally, after the threat, he gets back in his car and he drives away. And this all goes down on Easter morning. The 38-year-old Burger King employee, his name is Howard Vernon, he said, to know somebody would do something like that just because I'm trying to give him a better deal and flip out like that is scary. He said, I was taking this guy's order. He orders two sausage egg and cheese croissants and a sausage biscuit and hash browns. And the order comes out to $8. And he was like, my order can't be right. It should be like $11. And I'm like, trying to explain to him that we had a promotion going on. And it's like, cheaper. And he starts cussing and getting all loud. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know why you want to pay more money. He said after the guy speeds off, he pulls back around as he's helping this other customer. And that's when the guy pulls out the gun, threatens to kill him, and then starts using racial slurs against him. And the whole time the clerk said, Howard, the whole time Howard said, I was like, if you're going to do it, just do it. I'm not about to run. I'd be running, Howard. I don't know. You don't scare me or anything like that. Just do what you got to do, he said. And he just kept blurting out racial slurs. And he said it's so crazy because there was an older woman, like his gun was on top of this older woman's car. He could have given her a heart attack. Howard also says, it's crazy that people would just like, what if he did shoot me and kill me? You know, I have 10 kids. I don't know how you support 10 kids working at Burger King, but Howard, more power to you, man. He said, I would have been leaving all of my kids, like everything. So he hasn't been back to work since this whole thing happened at Easter. He says he does plan to return, but you're working with the public. People can be crazy. You imagine somebody trying to charge you less and that's what makes you angry? Thank you to Lee for that story. I really appreciate it. This is one of the stories that maybe sometimes you think about, you know, what would you take to a deserted island? If you were stranded on a desert island, what would you, or deserted island, what would you bring with you? I don't think these people really had the time to figure that out before they ended up here. It's beautiful, but it's also incredibly remote. And it's amazing that they were found. These are castaways in the Pacific. They were on a fishing trip, fishing, three men. They were fishing the waters around the Pikelot or Pikelot Atoll, which is in Micronesia. Happened on March 31st, when their 20-foot open skiff was caught by swells and its outboard motor was damaged. So they scramble ashore to this uninhabited island, Pikelot, P-I-K-E-L-O-T, Pikelot. But just before they can call for help, their radio runs out of battery power. So they're there for a week. What are they going to do? They gather palm fronds and they write this message in the sand. Out of palm fronds, help, you can see it. And thank goodness they did that, because that's what saved them. For a week, they say they lived off coconut meat. They did have fresh water from a small well on the island, because it's sometimes visited by fishers in that region. And their relatives realized they should be back by now. So they called the officials there. And the Coast Guard and the U.S. Navy put up a plane to kind of fly around and check. And that's when they spotted the palm fronds writing and the word help on the beach on April 7th. So they said the sign was crucial to finding these men in the search area that covered more than 103,000 square miles. They called this writing with the palm fronds an act of ingenuity, pivotal in guiding the rescue efforts directly to their location. So the Navy jet drops some survival packs to these three men, relays their location to the rescue center, and a day or so later, the Coast Guard sends out a chopper from Hawaii, dropped a radio to these men who were able to tell the crew that they were in good shape and that they were eager to get back home. So the Coast Guard cutter goes out and reaches this story. One of the first rescuers on the beach was this petty officer, second class, Eugene Halichlius, and he's Micronesian and he spoke the local language. And they could, he said, I could see on their faces, who's this guy pulling up that can speak our language? He said when he gave his first name to one of the stranded men, the castaway was stunned. He said, it's a crazy world. I actually found out I'm related to these guys. He couldn't believe it. I'm with the Coast Guard trying to rescue them. The guy was his third cousin. The others were fourth cousins. This wasn't the first rescue of castaways from this island of Pikelot. It happened in 2020. Three other men traveling between the atolls found themselves washed up there. They spelled out SOS on the beach. That was spotted by the crew of a U.S. Air Force tanker. So how does this happen on the same island twice in 4 years? They say it could be coincidence. Coast Guard says, the people of Micronesia frequently travel island to island, and they do so with a great deal of skill and experience, but occasionally accidents happen, and apparently so do unexpected family reunions. Pretty smart to write it out like that. Glad there was a well on that island. Looks like somebody was smart about it. Can you imagine? And look at that island. I mean, it's incredibly beautiful. 32 acres. That island is 32 acres. And it's really remote, like the middle of nowhere. They never would have found them, they said, if they hadn't have written that on the sand. So can we talk about this for a moment? This is a story that really could save a lot of lives. It's about AI, the possibility that AI could be used to help detect signs of ovarian cancer in blood. And we have a lot of, you know, we kind of ding AI a lot. How could it take over for humans, etc.? But if this works, this could be key. Because ovarian cancer, they often call it the silent killer, right? Because often, by the time you are diagnosed, it's really far along. If you're lucky enough to have this diagnosed early, fantastic. And I'm sure there are a lot of cases where people are diagnosed that, you know, it's a good outcome. But for a lot of people, actually for one woman I went to high school with, by the time she found out, it was way too late. And she died in her early 40s. So this is the fifth leading cause of cancer death in the United States. And as just mentioned, ovarian tumors are often lethal because they typically don't cause symptoms in their early, more treatable stages. So again, by the time they're uncovered, often things have spread. So this is a new piece of research where a highly accurate liquid biopsy or blood test for ovarian tumors could possibly work. So the study, the team from Johns Hopkins, focused on tiny fragments of the tumor's genetic material present in the patient's blood. And they say because cancer cells are rapidly growing and dying and have chaotic genomes as compared to healthy cells, patients with cancer have different patterns of DNA fragments in their blood than patients without cancer. This according to the study's author. By carefully analyzing these fragments across the entire human genome, they said we can detect subtle patterns indicating the presence of cancer. So the researchers left it to an artificial intelligence program to analyze the DNA blood fragmentomes of women with and without ovarian cancer. And the AI program combined that data with measurements of blood levels of two ovarian cancer biomarkers. The study involved 134 women with ovarian cancer and 204 women without, and 203 women with a benign mass. And the results of this study are being called very impressive. The test had a specificity of 99%, meaning that there were almost no women who got a false positive from their screening. The sensitivity in this AI test picked up ovarian cancers varying by cancer stage. It spotted stage one cancers 69% of the time, stage two cancers 76% of the time, stage three 85% of the time, and stage four 100% of the time. The level of accuracy significantly outperformed that of blood test based on a certain protein alone. So they need to do larger studies on this. This isn't big enough. But it's really promising, and they just presented it at this medical meeting and in this peer-reviewed journal. So this could be the way that ovarian cancer can be detected early, because even if you go in every year for your general checkup at the OB's office, right, the gynecologist's office, sometimes they miss things. And again, unless you're having pain, it's really hard for people to sometimes figure out exactly what's going on with you. So a test like this, this could be key. This story, I don't really understand the why of it, but it's about the gig worker economy and how, if you're a gig worker, like trying to cobble together a bunch of different jobs to make ends meet, like, I don't know, me, that it could lead to a risk of a higher risk of alcohol-related illnesses. The gig economy, they say, could be setting up young adults for drinking problems later in life. People who take poorly paid temp jobs or jobs as freelancers or independent contractors, apparently, according to this research, are 43% more likely to develop an alcohol-related illness than those with full-time permanent employment. This is a study published in the journal Occupational and Environmental Medicine. And it's mostly young people, they say. It's in a sensitive period in life concerning the initiation and formation of health-related behaviors like alcohol use. And so young adults with precarious employment, according to this research, might use alcohol as a coping strategy for stress and form a habit of consuming larger quantities of it compared with people in standard employment of the same age. So they looked at 340,000 people. This is a pretty big study, born between 1973 and 76. And they followed them and their employment status 3 years after they graduated from the highest level of education that they attained. 3 years was deemed to be the most suitable time to pinpoint the end of school to work transition. And they categorized each person's employment as precarious gig employment, long-term unemployment, substandard employment, standard full-time, etc. 39% of young adults had standard employment, 32% had substandard, 13% had precarious. And then they looked at their health records. And they found 2% of the participants were treated at least once for an alcohol-related illness over a 28-year time span. Two-thirds of those were men, actually. And people with the precarious gig jobs initially appeared to be almost twice as likely as those with full-time work to have an alcohol-related illness. So I guess maybe I'm in trouble. Pretty soon I'm going to start drinking. If I show up drunk, you'll know what it's because I'm doing the gig work. I don't know. All right, let's get to it. You ready? It is Trivia Thursday. That's right. I like my new little sign. And I know we've done this category before, but I thought, why not try it again? Because I found some new questions, I think. Anyway, this is a category, beverages, speaking of alcohol problems, but it's not all alcohol related. There's a lot of soda. There's a lot of other things in here as well. So the first question I will ask is, other than water, what's the most consumed beverage? So we'll do an easy one. We'll start with an easy one. Other than water, what is the most consumed beverage? Nope, it isn't coffee. I would have thought that. It is not beer, although that's a good answer. It is indeed tea, John Watson. Tea, Jim Shields. Well done. Yes, it's tea. Okay, next question. What U.S. state drinks the most, or what people in the U.S., which U.S. state, drink the most alcohol per person? So, the people in which U.S. state drink the most alcohol per person? What were you saying about hibiscus? Karen says the hibiscus is the Hawaii state flower, but it is not a native flower. I did not know that it was not a native flower. I love it, though. I love it. The answer is, let's see if you guys get it. Scrolling back a little bit. Not Alaska, not Utah, not California, although you'd think because we've got a lot of wine going on over here. It's not Florida. Good answer, though, Scott and Deidre. Not New York. Yes, Vanessa, it is indeed Nevada. Folks in Nevada drink the most alcohol per person, which I guess makes sense with Las Vegas. People are drinking. They're passing out drinks like hotcakes at the casino, right? Here's the question. In China, if you order white tea, what do you get? In China, if you order white tea, what do you get? Sick. I hope not. No, you don't get cocaine. No, you don't get milk and you don't get sake. You don't get milk tea or hot dog water. Good answer. Good callback. You get, yeah, interestingly, you get boiled water. That's all you get. If you order white tea, you get boiled water. Well done, Vanessa. Here's the question. Pulque is a beer made from what? Pulque, P-U-L-Q-U-E, don't Google it, is a beer made from what? Pulque is a beer made from? I don't know. Not coconut. Not seaweed. Good thought, though. Not yak milk, Jim. Kind of. I will say it's plant-based. Yeah? Pulque beer, no. Yes, Gordon. It is a beer made from cactus. Nice. What is the most complicated cocktail to create in the world, and how many ingredients is it made with? the most complicated cocktail to create in the world, and how many ingredients is it made with? Deidre, did you get it first? I'm sorry, I didn't see that. Deidre. Oh, you did. I'm sorry. My bad. I missed it. Sex on the beach. No. Long Island iced tea. No. It's pronounced pulque. Pulque. Okay. Thank you. I thought I might get it wrong. That's why I spelled it for you. Pulque. Not the Long Island iced tea. I don't know, but I want one. Maybe I should just give this one to you guys. I'll wait a half beat more. The most complicated... I'm claiming recount on the white tea as hot dog water. I don't know about that. Rocky Mountain beer, bear effer, which is made from draining the bar mat at the end of the night. Gross. No. Okay, the most complicated cocktail to create in the world is called the Commonwealth. To honor the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, it's made with 71 ingredients from around the world. So that's why it's the most complicated cocktail. 71 different ingredients. What cocktail is made with white cream de menthe and brandy? White cream de menthe and brandy. Sandy says, we used to call the bar mat drink a Matt Dillon at the bar where I used to work. Gross. Ew. Yes. Mint julep. No. No, it isn't. What's it called? The cocktail made with white cream de menthe and brandy. Should I just give you guys the answer? It sounds awful. Not Irish coffee. It's called a stinger. Is what it's called. In a bar, if you were to order a Boilermaker, what would you get? If you were in a bar and you ordered a Boilermaker, what would arrive in front of you? We need music. Beer with whiskey. Beer and whiskey. Shot of whiskey dropped into a beer. The answer is a shot of whiskey followed by a glass of beer. Well done, people. Between which years was the alcohol absinthe banned in the United States? Between which years was the alcohol absinthe banned in the United States? That might be a good thing, Heather. There's only enough room in our brains for... you know, the information we currently need. I saw a meme yesterday where someone was like, why is it that I can remember my childhood phone number, but I can't remember the password I just created 5 minutes ago, right? Real absinthe, they think, is still banned. I don't think so. Calvin says 1920 to 1926. Vanessa says 20 to 2020. Here's the answer. 1912 to 2007, according to the bar site that I'm looking at. On average, how many grapes does it take to make a bottle of wine? One bottle of wine. How many grapes go into making that wine? On average, how many grapes does it take to make one bottle of wine? And think... I mean, not hugely big, but think kind of big, because remember, you're squeezing out the juice, right? 3,500? 500? 24? Ooh, you guys are all over the map. Heather says, John says 1,200. Heather's like 500,000. When I mean big, I don't mean like wildly big. Lori says 10 pounds. That's not in pounds, it's in single grapes. How many grapes in one bottle of wine? I'll go for the closest answer thus far. 11,780. Nice. Great minds think alike, you guys. It is... Calvin, I think, is the closest to this. The answer is 400. It takes 400 grapes to make one bottle of wine. The word alcohol is a word derived from which language? The word alcohol is derived from which language? I would not have known this. Yes, John Watson, it is Arabic. Nice. It is Arabic. I didn't know it. Which famous politician's mother created the Manhattan cocktail? Which famous politician's mother is responsible for creating the Manhattan's cocktail? I pluralized it when I shouldn't have. Which famous politician's mother created the Manhattan cocktail? Not Roosevelt. Not Rockefeller. Not Adams. Not JFK, although that does make sense. Not Franklin. I'll give you the answer. It was not Giuliani. It was Winston Churchill's mom. What is it called when a bottle of champagne is opened with a sword? What is it called when a bottle of champagne is opened in dramatic fashion as somebody takes a sword and slices the top of the bottle? What's it called? Do we know? If you open a champagne bottle with your sword, you are stupid. A mess. The correct answer comes from Heather, and it is sabering. That's the answer. Sabering. Nice, Heather. What was the name of the Benedictine monk who invented champagne? What was the name of the Benedictine monk who invented champagne? My nieces do that at Christmas. You guys have a fun Christmas house, was what you have, Eileen. His name was Benedict? Because he's a Benedictine? No, his name wasn't Benedict, but I like the way you think. Yeah. Monk drunk? Nope. Chuck? Daryl? Yes, it was Dom Perignon. I'm gonna choose to think that was a misspelling. It was Dom Perignon. Yes. Yes, it was. Heather and Wes for the win on that one. In what year was the energy drink Rockstar introduced? In what year was the energy drink Rockstar introduced? George Santos. No, that's not his name. Rockstar. Sandy says 2000. Deidre says 1998. Yeah. The right answer on that one is 2001. So, yeah. I wouldn't have known this one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What is the nationality of the company that owns Capri Sun? I would never have gotten this, so I'll just tell you. It's German. The Germans own Capri Sun. Tropicana is owned by which company? Tropicana is owned by which company? Heather says, champagne is my religion. Well, then you should know all the champagne questions. Yes, that's right. Tropicana is owned by which company? Nope. And yes, Deidre gets it right. Pepsi owns Tropicana. Sandy got Capri Sun. Wow. I didn't notice that. Go back and look. Oh, yep. It's German. Absolutely. Well done, Sandy. I didn't think anybody would get that one. What is the primary flavoring ingredient in root beer? What is the primary flavoring ingredient in root beer? Are you my mom? I don't think Heather is anybody's mom. sassafras. That's exactly right, Deidre. Well done. It's sassafras. I think it's sassafras. Yeah, sassafras. In what year was Coca-Cola launched? In what year was Coca-Cola launched? Nope. This surprised me. I didn't realize it was that old. 1906, says Deidre. Karen says 1936. 05. Knit one, purl one, says 1890. Calvin says 1880. 1888. I got an 1887. The answer is 1886. So I'll go for, if you had between 1880 and 1890, I'll take it. Yeah, 1896. Well done, John. That's an old one. I didn't realize that was so old. I put this one in because of our Bay Area connection here. What popular two-word rum cocktail takes its name from the Tahitian word for good or excellent, but was actually invented in Oakland, California in 1944? Two-word rum cocktail takes its name from the Tahitian word for good or excellent, but was actually invented in the fine, fine city of Oakland, well before they were known for crime. Yes, you are correct. Let's see who got it first. I think it was Deidre from Mai Tai. Calvin from Mai Tai. You guys, that must have been an easy one. Mai Tai, Mai Tai. Yeah. Nice. There may have been many different flavors of pop created over the years. Dr. Brown's Soda puts out a soda with what unique ingredient in it? Dr. Brown's Soda puts out a product with what unique ingredient in it? Could be good. No, it's not cocaine. It's not rum. It's not alcoholic. Neither is it drug-induced. Prunes. No. Mm-mm. Yes. Uncle Jim 99 gets it. It's celery. They have celery in their soda. The flavor is extracted from the celery seed. It's been around since the 60s. All of Dr. Brown's sodas, I guess, are kosher, and they can be found in certain Jewish delicatessens. You can't find this drink at soda shops anymore, since soda shops really don't exist. Back in its day, it was a very popular drink, using chocolate syrup, milk, and soda water. What is it? So you could find it at soda shops back in the day. It has chocolate syrup, milk, and soda water. What is the name of the... Yes, it is. Wow, you got that one fast. It is Knit One, Purl One, and egg cream. Well done. I've never had one. Yeah. Many of the popular sodas were invented by men in what profession? Many popular sodas were invented by men in what profession? Close, Karen. No. No, not beer brewing, not barbers. Kind of in the medical profession, but you need to be more specific. Chemist? No. Monocle wearing, you would think. More than a clerk. They were not dentists. Yes, I'll give it to Jim. They were pharmacists. Many of the popular sodas were invented by not soda jerks, but pharmacists. Nice, Jim. Well done. Pharmacist examples are John Pemberton, who was a pharmacist who invented Coca-Cola. Pepsi was created by a pharmacist from North Carolina. A Waco, Texas pharmacist invented Dr. Pepper. So, in China, they have a drink made from an ingredient that has been used in a specialty soup for hundreds of years. What unique ingredient gives Bird's Nest drink its flavor? It's a unique ingredient in Bird's Nest drink. A Chinese drink. What's in there? It's not shark fin, thank goodness. Although I might prefer to eat that, which is a sad statement. It's not bird poop, but you're on the right track, my friend. Yes, it is indeed bird spit. It's gross. Well, it's gross to me. I shouldn't say that. Maybe it's the best drink you've ever had in your life. And if we're going to eat bird meat, then what's wrong with bird spit, right? Come on now. This is an interesting one. I would not have gotten the answer, so I might not give you guys long for this one. But another interesting soda comes from Japan. What ocean ingredient is the drink Unagi Nobori made of? What ocean ingredient is in Unagi Nobori? I've just had the bird's nest at Trader Joe's. I hope there's not bird spit in there. Ew. Eel. Yeah, you're right. Well done, Liz. I didn't think you'd get this, but you know what? A lot of people order unagi at sushi restaurants, so maybe we're familiar with the term. Unagi Nobori is a drink made from eel extract and vitamins found in fish. The drink apparently has the taste of broiled eels and is marketed for men who need energy. So there you go. That brings to a close Trivia Thursday. Woohoo! I wanted to tell you guys that I want to have something on Friday, a very quick thing, but I'm not going to be able to do it without your help. So this is male energy, and I think we all know what that means, Mr. Slade. Eel, well, sorry, you know, I had to end it somewhere. All right, because I've already kept you guys way too long, probably. But quickly before we go, I've been thinking of this for a while. This is my new meme of the week. Just a quick little meme, but hopefully you guys will be able to send me your favorite memes that you've seen. And I'll just pick one very quick little meme every week to flash on the screen and we can share it with each other. The meme of the week, you can email me, kim@theafterparty.live. Also, kgoinexile@gmail.com, another way to get a hold of me. And I may email you back from one of many email addresses. I don't know why I have so many right now, but feel free to email me at whichever address you can get a hold of me at or whichever one I've responded to you from. But kim@theafterparty.live, kgoinexile@gmail.com will all work, as will my name @gmail.com. So this is a meme of the week. And if you see anything that you think is worthy, please ship it over, because I'd love to have it and showcase it. And we'll do that on Friday. So by the time Friday rolls around, maybe you've seen something that made you chuckle or, you know, piques your interest. I thought that might be fun to do. Okay. Thank you for hanging out with me on Thursday. Thanks for participating in Thursday Trivia. And again, thank you to everyone who has taken the time to contribute to the show. I really appreciate it. I want to say that if you can't, I completely understand that too. And I'm grateful for you being here. But thank you to all these folks that have really helped keep this show going. I so appreciate you. And again, a huge after party aloha to you. You can see I love the hibiscus. I saw a hibiscus online last night. I've never seen the color before, so I think it's AI created. It was white and yellow with purple tips. I'll see if I can find it again and show it. So pretty. All right, until tomorrow, and again, tomorrow, no Nicki Maduro show. Mark Thompson show starts at 11. It's going to be a really good one. We'll have Michael Schur. We'll have Michael Snyder. We'll have Friday Fabulous Florida. And we're going to have a special guest for Friday Fabulous Florida as well. So it's going to be a great show. And then I'll see you back here. We'll do a meme of the week tomorrow on the After Party Live as we start our new segment. A little segment. A mini segment, anyway. Make it a great day, everybody. Have a great rest of your afternoon. And I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
The After Party Live would like to thank the following contributors and viewers like you.